weak shake of his head.
I decided to ride up here, see if I could find you, Edward. But I ran into some Apaches. I had to fight my way loose from them. Brought a bullet with me.
Yeah, I noticed that. You're dying, Nick.
Yeah, I know.
You want me and my boys to steal those rifles so this Diego Alcazario doesn't get them? Is that right?
Figure he'll hit the train when it stopped at Sweet Apple. I won't be expecting you to hit him.
That's right. We'll take the bastards by surprise. But when will the train be at Sweet Apple, Nick? I have to know when the train will get there.
In my pocket. Train schedule. Details about the shipment. You can make a big cleanup, Edward. Just kill Alcazario for me.
Sure, Nick. Sure.
He lifted one side of the wounded man's jacket and reached inside to search for the papers Carlisle mentioned. He found them in an inside pocket, a little bloodstained around the edges, but legible. A quick scan of them told Mallory everything he needed to know. The train carrying the shipment of army rifles in one of its baggage cars wasn't due to arrive in Sweet Apple for another week. He delayed this long, Mallory thought. For the sort of payoff he could get for 500 brand-new repeating rifles, he could wait another week to strike, and the rest of the outlaws would be willing to do that too once they heard what was at stake. Plus, there was the matter of avenging the double-cross Diego Alcazario pulled on Carlisle and his partner, a Major Trevor. Nick promised for years to use his military connections to let Mallory in on something big. It was the main reason Mallory stayed in touch with the man and kept him up to date on his plans, just for something like this. Now, the stars finally lined up right, except Carlisle wasn't going to be alive to enjoy the fruits of his efforts, of course. But that didn't matter all that much to Mallory. Sentiment only went so far. He was willing to carry out Carlisle's wish for revenge on the treacherous Mexicans, but in the end, the man's death really meant one less share of the profits to give up.
Don't worry, Nick. We'll get those guns.
Mallory noticed Carlisle's eyes were glassy. His old friend was dead.
What the hell's going on here, Deuce?
I'll explain everything, Steve, but the short answer is that we're going to wait a little longer before we hit Sweet Apple. When we do, though, it's going to make us even richer than we thought.
Rebecca Jimerson carried the telegram into Cornelia Standish's private office and laid it on his desk. The message was in a sealed envelope, as Standish instructed. He didn't want anyone except Rebecca to get wind of his plans for Seymour. She was the only one he trusted, and he didn't have complete confidence in her. He glared at the yellow envelope.
Is that from Texas?
I don't know. It was sealed when the messenger brought it.
Standish picked up the envelope and tore it open with eager fingers. Rebecca knew what he hoped to find in there. The news his nephew Seymour was dead in Sweet Apple. But as Standish read the message, an angry frown appeared on his face.
Damn it!
Something wrong?
You always were a perceptive little bitch.
Rebecca kept a tight lid on her own anger. One of these days he would regret how he treated her, she told herself. Even as the thought went through her head, she knew how unlikely it was. She liked the comforts and luxuries money provided too much to ever risk losing her position. Besides, she was afraid of Cornelia Standish. Probably with good reason.
I know you hired private detectives to keep an eye on Seymour. Is that wire from one of them?
Yes. He's in San Antonio. He says Seymour has become something of a celebrity in a very short time. Some newspaper man dubbed him the most cowardly man in the West.
Rebecca's smile had a touch of sadness to it. The description certainly suited poor Seymour.
But here's the worst thing. Those idiots in Sweet Apple made him the town marshal.
The town marshal? Seymour?
That's right. It's ludicrous. It's insane.
Of course it is, but I don't understand why you're upset about that. You wanted Seymour to run into trouble, didn't you?
I wanted one of those Western gunmen to blow holes in him. But according to the detective in San Antonio, the Texas newspapers say he's been successful in facing down several gunfighters. He saved a woman's life and even fought off an ambusher. What the hell is wrong with those Texans? They can't even kill one quivering little mouse of a man like Seymour! Ah! I should have known if I wanted something done about this problem, I'd have to take more direct action myself. You simply can't rely on anyone to do what they're supposed to do these days.
Rebecca found herself wondering if the woman Seymour saved was young and pretty. Not that it mattered to her, of course. She had her moment of pity and weakness when she took the gun to him before he left Trenton. Since then, she hardened herself to the possibility she would never see Seymour Standish again. That was just the way things must be. But from what Seymour's uncle was saying, not only was Seymour surviving in Texas, he was thriving, flourishing even. Was it possible a man lived under that meek exterior after all? The question was more intriguing to Rebecca than she would have expected it to be.
Send for Wilford Grant. I want to see him.
Rebecca frowned. She didn't like Wilford Grant. Standish hired him on a couple of occasions in the past, when some of the employees of Standish Dry Goods, Inc. started talking about forming a union. A few broken legs and busted heads persuaded the employees to abandon the foolish notion. Wilford Grant and a few of his equally brutal friends provided the incentive. Rebecca knew Grant could usually be found in the bar of the Metropole Hotel, several blocks away.
I'll find a boy to take a message to him.
Right away.
Rebecca sent for Grant and went back to her desk, to her work. But a feeling of worry nagged her. She could hardly believe the things Standish told her about Seymour. She wished she could see them for herself, with her own eyes. Wilford Grant sauntered into Cornelius Standish's office, accompanied by one of his henchmen, a cadaverous Italian named Morelli. Grant was a little below medium height, but more than broad enough to make up for it. His shoulders were massive, his arms hung down like an ape's. He wore a brown tweed suit with a brown derby shoved back on a thatch of coarse black hair. What appeared to be several days' worth of beard stubble fuzzed his thick jaw. He always looked that way. More like an animal than a man, Rebecca thought. But he had plenty of human cunning.
Go right in. He's waiting for you.
You sure you don't want us to visit with you for a while?
Grant always looked at Rebecca with open lust in his eyes. Today was no different.
No, Mr. Standish is waiting for you.
Grant shrugged and went to the door of the inner office.
You got some work for me and Spike, Mr. Standish?
Indeed I do. How would the two of you feel about taking a trip west?
If the money's right, we'll go anywhere you want and do anything you want.
Even though Rebecca couldn't see Standish, she could imagine the evil smile on his thin lips.
That's just what I wanted to hear. You'll be going to Texas. My nephew, Seymour, is there, and there's a message I want you to give him. Morelli, close the door.
Rebecca knew exactly what Cornelius Standish was explaining to Wilford Grant and Spike Morelli. He was telling them to go to Texas and kill Seymour. Seymour crouched. His eyes narrowed in a determined squint, and his hand hovered over the butt of the gun on his hip. His upper lip drew back in a snarl calculated to strike fear into the heart of the man he was facing.
You'll rue the day you ever rode into Sweet Apple, you miscreant. You see this badge? This is my town. I'm Marshal Seymour Standish. Now slap leather.
He grabbed the pistol and jerked it out of the holster. He figured out he didn't have to cock it in order to fire it. The two requirements were point at the target and pull the trigger. He did so, still snarling. That wasn't too bad, Seymour decided as he lowered the weapon. He got the gun out fairly quickly, or at least it seemed so to him, and he didn't drop it this time. A plus. But the words he spoke were ridiculous. He wished he'd read more dime novels so he knew how a Western lawman was supposed to talk. Somehow, he couldn't imagine a real frontier marshal calling someone a miscreant. Seymour holstered the gun and got ready to try his draw again. He had been practicing for half an hour, and his arm was beginning to ache, but it was important he get more proficient with a firearm. So far, he had been lucky. In his week as Marshal of Sweet Apple, no more gunfighters braced him, and there was only the one bushwhacking attempt. The professional shootists didn't want to have anything to do with him because of the potential damage to their reputations if they killed him. Since he was fortunate enough to both survive the ambush and wound the man in the alley, anyone else who wanted him dead must be thinking twice about risking another attempt. Seymour knew he was lucky to be alive. But what was the old saying? Fortune favors the bold? Well, if he could grow bolder, perhaps fortune would favor him even more. It was worth a try. He was thinking about his name. Seymour Standish didn't really sound like the name of a Texas lawman when the office door opened. Seymour swung around to see who was there, and as he did, he realized he should have loaded his gun. Carrying it around empty probably wasn't too wise. But his visitor was Miss Maggie O'Ryan. Ever since he first met her, he felt drawn to her. She was smart, beautiful, courageous, everything. In short, much too fine a woman for the likes of him. But he couldn't help the way he felt.
Good evening, Miss O'Ryan.
He noticed she looked worried.
What can I do for you?
I've just been to visit one of my students. He wasn't in school today, so I thought I'd go by and see if he was ill.
Very conscientious and commendable of you.
Maggie's face was grim.
He wasn't in school because yesterday his father beat him so badly the poor boy couldn't walk today.
Seymour's eyebrows went up.
How terrible! I hope you're going to report this to the proper Oh. That's what you're doing, isn't it? I'm the proper authorities.
You may not have noticed, Seymour, but people in Sweet Apple are starting to respect you instead of laughing at you. You've done a good job as marshal.
Seymour wasn't sure what pleased him more, the compliment or the fact she called him by his first name.
It's only been a week, and I haven't really done that much.
You've stopped 3 saloon fights, and you jailed 2 men who were drunk and firing their guns in the air. Someone could have been hurt in all of those incidents.
I'm a salesman by trade, you know. Not a very good one, maybe, but I do know how to talk to people. I was fortunate to persuade those men to settle their differences without violence. As for the 2 men I arrested, well, they were really too inebriated to put up much of an argument.
You just let them sleep it off and then release them in the morning. You could have fined them or made them stay in jail longer.
Seymour shook his head.
There didn't seem to be any point in that. They were already so hungover, they were suffering a considerable punishment.
Even so, people can see you're a reasonable man, and they like that. You're winning them over, Seymour.
Maggie looked down at the floor.
You've won me over. I wasn't sure how good a lawman you'd be, but now I think you're doing a fine job.
Seymour's heart swelled. If Maggie admired him as a lawman, then how did she feel about him as a man? He wondered how she would feel about having dinner with him some evening at the cafe. At the moment, she was more concerned with her unfortunate student. She looked up.
That's why I think you should go see Mr. Dietrich. If you told him to stop mistreating Randolph, he might listen to you.
Seymour couldn't stop a dubious frown from appearing on his face.
I don't know about that, Maggie.
If she was going to call him Seymour, surely it would be all right if he called her Maggie. She didn't object to the familiarity as he went on.
After all, a parent has the right to discipline a child however he sees fit.
Within reason. Whipping a child until he can't walk isn't reasonable.
I agree with you, but the law doesn't really make any distinction about such things.
How do you know about the law? You were a dry goods salesman before you pinned on that badge.
Seymour winced a little. He liked Maggie O'Ryan, liked her a great deal. But she could be plain-spoken, even blunt, on occasion. Like now.
I found a law book in the desk. I suppose one of the previous holders of this job left it behind. I've been reading it at night, studying it. Enforcing the law is my job now, you know.
She crossed her arms and gave him an intent look.
Well, I'm making an official complaint against Gunther Dietrich, and as the marshal, you're required to investigate.
I am?
You are.
Seymour wasn't sure she was right, but he supposed it wouldn't do any harm to go have a talk with this Dietrich fellow. As he told Maggie, he was usually able to use his salesman skills to persuade people to do what he wanted. Well, sometimes, anyway. He reached for his hat.
Where can I find Mr. Dietrich?
I'll show you.
I don't know if it's a good idea for you to come along.
Randolph is my student. I'm going.
Seymour could tell he would be wasting his time by arguing. He put his hat on and nodded.
All right. But if there's any trouble, let me handle it. That's my job.
Of course.
Fear hopped around inside him like a spooked rabbit as he and Maggie walked along the street. He wondered how big Gunther Dietrich was.
What does Mr. Dietrich do for a living?
He works at the wagon yard.
Seymour nodded. It sounded like Dietrich might be a pretty burly fellow. All the more reason to resolve this peacefully. The Dietrich family lived in a small adobe house not far from the wagon yard. It was just Randolph and his father, Maggie explained. The boy's mother passed away several years earlier. That was probably one reason Maggie was so concerned about him, Seymour thought. Her maternal instinct made her want to take care of the motherless boy. Lantern light shone through the windows of the house. Keeping a tight rein on his nervousness, Seymour marched up to the door, followed by Maggie. When the door opened, the huge shape of the man inside seemed to blot out the light from the lantern. His bullet-shaped head was devoid of hair, except for a pair of bushy eyebrows.
Yeah? What do you want?
Seymour had trouble finding his voice. He swallowed a couple of times. Maggie must have grown impatient because she leaned past him.
This is Marshal Standish, Mr. Dietrich. I've told him about what happened to Randolph.
So you went running to the law, did you?
Angered by the way the man looked at Maggie, Seymour finally spoke up.
Mr. Dietrich, it's been reported to me that you're mistreating your son. I've come to ask you to cease such behavior.
What?
Stop whipping Randolph.
He's my boy. I'll do whatever I see fit to do. I got the right.
Not necessarily.
Seymour thought back over some of the things he read in the battered old law book he found in the marshal's desk.
There are certain provisions in the law that allows the authorities to remove a child from circumstances that endanger him.
More anger welled up inside him, momentarily overcoming the nervousness and fear.
I would think that being beaten past the point of being able to walk would certainly qualify.
Dietrich frowned and shook his head.
What are you saying?
The marshal is going to take Randolph away from you if you don't start treating him better.
Dietrich's eyebrows jerked around like caterpillars on a hot rock.
Take my boy away from me? You'll go to hell first.
He stepped forward and swung a fist like a sledgehammer at Seymour's head. The attack didn't take Seymour completely by surprise. He was able to tell from the first moment of the confrontation how belligerent Dietrich was, and knew things might come to this. With his heart pounding, he ducked under the sweeping roundhouse blow.
Maggie, get back!
Seymour hoped she had the sense to stay out of the struggle. He leaped to the side as Dietrich swung again, this time an uppercut that would have taken Seymour's head off had it connected. He put his hand on his gun.
Mr. Dietrich, stop it! Stop it or I'll have to arrest you!
Dietrich lunged at Seymour with his arms wide spread, obviously intending to wrap up the smaller man in a bone-crushing bear hug. Seymour twisted away at the last second. He knew he would stand no chance against the monstrous Dietrich in a fist fight. He had to resort to his gun. His still empty gun, since putting the bullets back in it, totally slipped his mind after Maggie interrupted his practice in the marshal's office. Still, the revolver was less likely to break on Dietrich's skull than his hands were. As Dietrich stumbled past him, Seymour yanked the gun from its holster and swung it as hard as he could at Dietrich's head. Dietrich didn't go down, though, as Seymour hoped he would. Instead, he brought around an arm like the trunk of a young tree in a sweeping blow that crashed against Seymour's chest and knocked him off his feet. Seymour went down hard, but managed to hang on to the gun. Dietrich wheeled around and launched a kick at Seymour. Panic erupted inside him at the thought of the big man stomping him to death. He rolled aside frantically, again causing Dietrich to miss. This time, Dietrich was thrown off balance. As he tried to catch himself, Seymour lashed out and kicked him in the knee. Dietrich landed so hard on his back, all the breath was knocked out of his body. Seymour scrambled over to him and hit him with the gun again. This time, Dietrich's eyes rolled up in their sockets. Then he lay still, passed out. Maggie rushed to Seymour as he pushed himself to his feet. She clutched his arms.
Oh, are you all right? Did he hurt you?
No, I'm fine. Just a bit winded.
And still scared. His heart was pounding like a locomotive again, its usual reaction to fear. But he felt a surge of fierce satisfaction as he looked at Dietrich's motionless form stretched on the ground in front of the house. Seymour could barely believe he managed to subdue such a brute. Again, luck was on his side. Not only that, but Seymour was beginning to realize a healthy dose of fear was not necessarily a bad thing. It made a man move faster and fight harder. The voice from inside the house made both Seymour and Maggie turn. A small blonde boy hobbled forward, obviously in pain. Maggie rushed over to him and knelt to hug him.
It's all right, Randolph. Your father won't hurt you anymore.
The boy looked past Seymour at the unconscious form of his father.
Pa!
He tried to pull loose from Maggie's arms. Seymour put a hand on her shoulder.
Let him go. He's worried about his father.
She looked up at him, frowning in confusion.
But the man mistreated him.
He's still the boy's father. Maggie, please, let him go.
Pa, are you going to be all right?
Seymour took cartridges from the loops on his belt and began loading his gun.
I'm sorry I had to hit him like that, son. He didn't give me any choice. I hope in the future he'll treat you a little better. I certainly hope so. If he doesn't, you let me know.
Randolph looked up at him.
Are you going to arrest him, Marshal?
Not this time. If he treats you right from now on, I won't have to.
Seymour patted the boy's shoulder.
You get better now, son. We need you back in school.
He looked toward the street, feeling eyes watching him, and was surprised to see a group of townspeople gathered.
Can a couple of you men come help Mr. Dietrich back into his house?
Two of the townies hurried forward to do as Seymour asked.
Are you sure you shouldn't arrest him?
I think he deserves a chance to learn from this.
Seymour hoped his confidence wasn't misplaced. But while he had that confidence, he went on.
Would you do me the honor of having dinner with me tomorrow night, Miss Orion?
Since he was asking such a momentous question, it seemed proper to speak more formally. Maggie blinked in surprise.
I think I'd like that, Marshal Standish.
Seymour smiled. To simply smile took considerable restraint. What he wanted to do was let out a whoop of glee and leap into the air. He nodded.
I'll call for you at 6 o'clock.
That will be fine. And thank you for helping me this evening.
He gave his hat brim a tug.
That's my job, miss. Now, with your permission, I'll walk you home.
Maggie hesitated, but again, only for a second. Then she linked her arm with his and smiled.
Thank you, Marshal.
As they walked off, Seymour glanced at the crowd again. He thought he saw several admiring gazes from the townspeople. Maybe they really were coming to respect him, as Maggie said. What he didn't notice was J. Emerson Heathcote, editor and publisher of the Sweet Apple Gazette, scribbling furiously on a pad of paper with the stub of a pencil. Heathcote's pudgy face bore the look of a man who just stumbled over a buried trove of treasure.
Was this town here the last time we were down this way?
Sam Two Wolves and Matt Bodine rode slowly down the main street of the settlement a week after departing the Dutchman's.
I don't think so.
He pointed to an elevated water tank next to the double line of gleaming steel rails.
There's why. The railroad hadn't come through yet. The locomotives needed a water stop here, so Viola, a town.
Why'd you call me Viola?
I didn't call you Viola. It's a French word, means, well, there it is, I reckon.
No, Viola is a woman's name, or a musical instrument, sort of like a violin. You're thinking of V-O-I-L-A, pronounced voila. That's the French word you meant, surely.
Maybe so, but don't call me Shirley.
They glared at each other for a second, then grinned. Sam reined in and called over to a skinny man lounging in the doorway of a general store.
Hey, friend, what's the name of this place?
They call it Marfa. Don't ask me why, because I ain't got no idea.
Judging by his garb, he was a cowboy, like most of the other men Matt and Sam saw in the settlement. With the Apache threat over for the most part in West Texas, cattlemen were moving in and establishing ranches sprawled over vast areas. The afternoon sun was nearing the horizon, and Matt and Sam were grateful they reached a town. They wouldn't have to spend another night on the trail. They could wash the dust out of their throats, get a decent meal, sleep in real beds, maybe even take a bath. Then, after replenishing their supplies, they could start the last leg of their journey. Sweet Apple wasn't more than 2 days' ride, they estimated. Matt edged his horse closer to the store's porch.
Been any trouble around here lately?
What sort of trouble?
Outlaws?
Ain't heard nothing about that. Been plumb peaceful in these parts, except on payday. Then the boys from the spreads hereabouts come into town and blow off a little steam.
You know where Sweet Apple is?
Sure. Up on the railroad, about 30, 40 mile.
You haven't heard about any ruckuses up there?
Nope. How come you boys so interested in trouble? Looking to make some?
Not hardly. We're just like what you said it's been around here, mister. Plum peaceful.
Uh-huh.
The cowboy didn't look or sound convinced.
Peaceful.
Matt and Sam hitched their horses into motion again and headed on down the street toward a large adobe building with a sign on it proclaiming it to be a hotel.
It stands to reason if Mallory and his gang raided Sweet Apple already, someone here would have heard about it.
Yeah. You reckon that means they haven't hit the place yet?
That's the only thing that makes sense.
Why not? We know that's where they're headed. And they were far enough ahead of us, they should have hit Sweet Apple a couple of days ago.
Something happened to delay them. Or Mallory changed his plans for some reason and isn't going there anymore.
That's what happened. And how in blazes are we going to find them? They could be anywhere west of the Trinity by now.
Sam could only shrug. They came to a livery stable before they reached the hotel and stopped there to make arrangements for their saddle mounts and pack horses for the night. Then they moved on to rent a pair of rooms. The hotel clerk looked a little askance at Sam and might have been about to say something about his Indian blood, but the sight of the double eagles Matt dropped on the desk changed his mind. They brought their saddlebags with them from the livery stable. As they were about to go upstairs to their rooms, something caught Sam's eye. He picked up a folded newspaper from one of the chairs in the lobby and asked the clerk,
"Mind if I borrow this?"
"You can have it as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Two Wolves. Someone who's staying here must have left it."
"Thanks."
"Interested in catching up on the news? Might be something about Mallory and his gang in there."
"That's not why I picked it up."
He followed Matt into one of the rooms they rented and unfolded the newspaper.
"I saw something about Sweet Apple."
He pointed to one of the headlines.
"Scaredest man in the West becomes fighting marshal."
"Let me see that. I didn't know Sweet Apple had a marshal. The place has got such a bad reputation, I'm surprised anybody would take the job."
Both of them scanned the densely printed columns of type. The newspaper was the Sweet Apple Gazette, edited and published by one J. Emerson Heathcote, according to the masthead. It was dated the day before, so the Blood Brothers knew someone on an eastbound train must have picked it up in Sweet Apple, probably read it on the train, then discarded it in the hotel. In flowery prose under the byline of J. Emerson Heathcote himself, the story told how Seymour Standish, late of Trenton, New Jersey, arrived in Sweet Apple a little over a week earlier and quickly established a dubious reputation as Seymour the Lily-Livered, the most cowardly man in the West. But through a bizarre set of circumstances, Standish took on the job of town marshal, in addition to being a traveling salesman for Standish Dry Goods, Inc., also of Trenton, New Jersey, the job that brought him to Texas in the first place. To everyone's enormous surprise, no doubt including Standish himself, he was doing a good job as marshal, heading off some saloon brawls, surviving an ambush attempt, and knocking out a local bully.
"This is damn near the craziest thing I've ever heard. Whose idea was it to make a rabbity traveling salesman the marshal of Sweet Apple?"
"It makes sense in a bizarre way. What's more important to most gunfighters than anything else?"
"Their reputation. I see what you're getting at. Folks would laugh at a man who went out of his way to kill some cowardly little worm."
"From the sound of this newspaper story, though, Marshal Standish is getting a reputation of his own. If he's not careful, that'll get him killed."
"Well, there's nothing in here about Mallory's gang attacking the town, so I reckon that answers our question about whether or not they've raided Sweet Apple yet."
"Unless Mallory hit the town today. That's yesterday's paper."
"Yeah. Maybe those folks over in Sweet Apple are just a hell of a lot luckier than they know. We'll head over there first thing in the morning. If Mallory hasn't gotten there yet, we can warn this Marshal Standish."
"You mean we'll tell the most cowardly man in the West that a gang of 30 or 40 vicious outlaws is on its way to kill him and loot the town he's supposed to protect?"
"I reckon that'll be a good test of just how much Seymour Standish has grown in the job."
The Blood Brothers enjoyed a good night's sleep in the hotel and a hearty breakfast in the place's dining room. Now they were about ready to hit the trail again.
We're idiots.
Speak for yourself. How come you think we're idiots?
We're going to spend the next 2 days in the saddle when we could take the train and be in Sweet Apple before the day is over.
We didn't know that. We hadn't checked the schedule at the train station.
Only because we're too dumb to think of it.
Well, let's go down there and take a look now. If that's a westbound pulling in, it sure would be quicker to catch a ride.
As they reached the depot, the train was steaming to a stop with a locomotive positioned to take on water from the elevated tank. It was indeed a westbound. Matt held the horses while Sam hurried into the station to buy tickets and arranged to have their horses loaded onto one of the cars. Luckily, there was room for them and the four animals. With reins in his hand, Matt stood beside the steps leading down from the station's platform. The rails were only a few yards away. The puffing and hissing of steam made the horses a mite skittish.
Easy, boys.
While he was doing that, his eyes noted a couple of women on the platform. Young ladies, actually, probably around 20 years old. Both wore traveling outfits. One was a blonde, the other had coppery red hair under her neat little hat. They climbed down from one of the passenger cars and strolled along the platform, stretching their legs before boarding the train again, Matt thought, although it wasn't really proper to think of legs where young women were concerned. Those were limbs they walked around on. And mighty pretty limbs, too, Matt was willing to bet. Pretty or not, Matt had other things on his mind besides women. His attention drifted away from them. A few minutes later, Sam came out of the station. He showed the tickets. Matt nodded. Then his head snapped around as a loud, angry voice came from the other end of the platform.
Come on, darling. Ain't no need for you to act like that. My pardon me, just want you and your friends to come have a drink with us.
Matt saw two men confronting the pair of attractive young women he noticed earlier. The men were large, unshaven, and roughly dressed. Each carried a big gun on his hip. Matt's eyes narrowed as the two women tried to step around the men, only to have the hombres move to block them. The blonde woman spoke up.
Just leave us alone, or you'll be sorry, you saddle tramps.
The redhead's temper matched her hair. One of the men stepped closer to her, glowering at her.
No call for you to talk to us like that.
Matt looked around, saw a post nearby, and wrapped the horse's reins around it, pulling them tight. Sam was almost to the end of the platform.
What are you...
Matt nodded toward the two men and two women. Sam turned, saw their tense, angry attitudes.
We're going to take cards in that game, aren't we?
Unless those two varmints fold pretty quick like we are.
The conductor appeared next to one of the passenger cards and hollered.
Board!
We have to get on the train.
She tried again to get around the men, blocking her and her friend. One of them reached out and grabbed her roughly by the arm.
Not until you had that drink with us, gal.
As Matt and Sam passed the conductor, Matt looked over at the blue-uniformed man.
Hold that train!
Young fella, I can't...
He said hold the train. We have tickets, and so do those two young ladies.
The conductor swallowed, recognizing the dangerous looks on the faces of the two big, muscular young men.
All right, but make it fast.
They were already past him by the time he spoke.
Let go of her!
The woman hauled off and punched an hombre in the face. Blood dribbled from his nose where the redhead's hard little fist connected solidly.
Oh, you damn hellcat. I'll paddle your behind.
No, you won't. Step away from those two ladies, both of you.
Right now.
The men swung around, fury on their beard-stubbled faces.
You two boys run along. This ain't none of your business.
My brother and I are making it our business. Leave those ladies alone.
You don't have to do this. We can take care of ourselves.
The two hard cases ignored her, and so did Matt and Sam.
Brother? He looks like a stinking half-breed to me.
You say that like it's a bad thing. I prefer to think of it as having the best of two different heritages.
Well, I think you stink, Injun.
Sam glanced over at Matt.
This man's inventory of insults seems to be rather limited.
I reckon that's because he's a half-breed, too. Half pig, half skunk.
The man's face contorted with hate and rage.
I'll kill you, you bastard!
He clawed at the revolver on his hip. In one quick motion, Matt stepped forward and slammed a fist into the man's face. The other man lunged at Matt, swinging a fist at his head. Sam intercepted him and grabbed his arm. Pivoting smoothly, Sam hauled on the man's arm, stuck his hip out, and executed a neatly done wrestling throw. With the fight knocked out of both of the lecherous hard cases, Matt and Sam turned to the two young women.
None of that display was necessary. We could have handled those two ourselves.
Yeah. You look like you were doing a fine job.
We were getting around to it.
Her hand moved near the stylish little bag she carried, and a pistol appeared as if by magic. Matt blinked in surprise, and when he looked over at the blonde, he saw she was holding a gun as well.
If they'd pushed us much farther, we would have ventilated the varmints.
But our fathers taught us not to kill anybody we don't have to.
Matt and Sam both stared. The two young women might be dressed like Easterners, but clearly they were both frontier gals. They held the guns like they knew how to use them and wouldn't hesitate to do so.
Gentlemen, we're falling behind schedule. Can the train leave now?
I reckon. Were you ladies ready to go?
More than ready. I wish we hadn't gotten out here to stretch our legs.
She didn't say limbs, Matt noted. Another indication they weren't the prissy Eastern girls they appeared to be. Matt and Sam moved aside and let the two women go ahead of them toward the steps leading up to the vestibule at the front of the passenger car where they rode. Behind them, the two hard cases struggled to their feet. They lurched upright and reached for their guns. Instinct warned Matt and Sam at the same moment. They whirled, their hands streaking for their Colts.
Good Lord! I never saw shooting like that before.
I'm sorry, ladies. Those fellows didn't give us much of a choice, though.
I never saw anybody so slick on the draw. Who are you, mister?
That's Matt Bodine, and I am Sam Twowolves.
The conductor's eyes widened even more, though that didn't seem possible.
Bodine and Twowolves? The notorious gunfighters?
I don't know how notorious we are. We never sought a reputation as gunfighters.
They're both dead. I looked through the lobby and I think I saw a fellow with a tin star in his shirt running up the street. Reckon you'll have to hold that train a little longer, Mr. Conductor.
The nervous conductor fidgeted and fumed as the train was delayed a little more than half an hour while the Marshal of Marfa questioned Matt and Sam and the two young women. The lawman's eyes narrowed in suspicion when he learned who Matt and Sam were. Their reputation preceded them, even in this new, isolated little settlement in far west Texas. But the marshal recognized the names of the young women, too. When the redhead introduced herself as Jessica Colton and the blonde said she was Sandra Paxton. Finally, his questions answered, the marshal let the train move on.
All aboard!
I think we can protect ourselves now. There shouldn't be any more trouble between here and Sweet Apple.
I hope not. We're a peaceable sort, Sam and me.
Oh, one killing before breakfast is enough for you? Is that it?
You said it yourself. Those men didn't give us any choice. We don't go around looking for gunfights, no matter what you may have heard about us.
Oh, so you're so famous we're supposed to have heard of you?
That star packer back there sure had.
Yes, and he seemed to think you were a pair of troublemakers.
Look, we were just trying to help you.
Stop.
There's no point in arguing all the way to Sweet Apple. It really won't take all that long to get there, so why don't we try to pass the time pleasantly?
Sounds like a good idea to me. Why don't we start by you ladies telling us some more about yourselves?
Jessica looked like she thought that wasn't a very good idea, but Sandra went ahead.
Our fathers sent us back east to school, as we mentioned before.
They thought we needed somebody to teach us to be proper young ladies. As if that's important out here in Texas. We already knew how to ride and rope and shoot.
There are other things to life besides those.
Jessica's look made it clear she didn't agree, but she didn't say anything.
You sound like an educated man, Mr. Twowolves.
I went to school in the East also.
For the next few minutes, they talked about their educations. From the corner of his eye, Matt watched Sam and could tell his blood brother was a mite taken with Sandra Paxton. He couldn't say the same for himself where Jessica Colton was concerned. That hombre who grabbed her back in Marfa was right about one thing. She was a hellcat, a red-headed hellcat at that. Matt pitied the gent who ever got involved with her. Over the next half hour, more information about the young women came out as Sam and Sandra talked. Matt found himself interested in spite of himself. It seemed their fathers, Shadrach Colton and Esau Paxton were cousins and came to West Texas with their wives a little more than 20 years earlier to start a ranch near where the settlement of Sweet Apple eventually sprang up. Jessica and Sandra were both born out here, only a few days apart, in fact. They were raised together and were best friends as well as second cousins. The CP Ranch, for Colton and Paxton, of course, flourished despite harsh weather, Indian threats, and Mexican rustlers who raided across the Rio Grande just as the Apaches. Somewhere along the way, something happened to drive a wedge between the cousins. The final split occurred while Sandy and Jesse, as they were known, were off at school. The Colton and Paxton families had separate homes anyway, so the spread was divided and each house served as the headquarters for a new ranch.
Do you know what happened to cause the trouble between them? Not that it's any of my business, but I'm curious.
No. Whatever it was, our fathers kept it to themselves. But we haven't let it affect us, have we, Jesse? We're still the best of friends.
I just hope that doesn't change once we get back.
Nothing's going to come between us. We've been through too much together. Why, once we helped fight off an Indian attack when we were only 11 years old. One of the men defending a rifle port was wounded, so Jesse grabbed up his gun and told me to load for her.
Jessica smiled at the memory.
My shoulder was bruised for a month from the recoil of that rifle, but I dusted the britches of several of those damned Apaches. No offense intended, Mr. Two Wolves.
None taken. Matt and I have had our own run-ins with the Apaches.
I hope you ladies do manage to stay friends. Might not be easy if your families are feuding, though.
Maybe it hasn't gotten that bad.
I hope not. Why are you and Mr. Bodine going to Sweet Apple? Not that it is any of my business.
Matt and Sam looked at each other for a second.
We're looking for some fellows.
Sam offered no further explanation. Since it was possible the Mallory gang might not attack Sweet Apple, it didn't make sense to panic folks just yet. They would talk to the marshal there first.
Oh.
The engineer highballed it, trying to make up for the time lost in Marfa, but there were several flag stops between there and Sweet Apple. It was nearly midday when the train rolled up to the Sweet Apple station. Matt and Sam looked the town over with great interest. No buildings were on fire, the street wasn't littered with the bodies of men and horses, and folks strolled calmly about. Deuce Mallory hadn't been there yet. That was for damn sure.
Sweet Apple! Sweet Apple! We'll be here 15 minutes!
Matt and Sam got to their feet, as did Sandy and Jesse.
Can we help you with your bags?
No, our folks will be here and probably some of the ranch hands. We don't need your help.
But thank you anyway.
That was fine with Matt. He wanted to find the sheriff and deliver the warning about Mallory's gang. He jerked his head at Sam.
Come on, let's get the horses.
Sam tugged on the brim of his hat and smiled at the women.
So long, ladies. It was an honor and a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Thank you for everything, Mr. Two Wolves. And you too, of course, Mr. Bodine.
I still say we could have handled those galoots by ourselves.
Jessica headed for the car's vestibule without looking back. Matt and Sam went the other way, dropped down from the rear platform without the aid of steps. As they walked along the station platform toward the livestock cars, Sam looked back over his shoulder. So did Matt, allowing his curiosity to get the better of him for a moment. Two separate groups of people were waiting for Jesse and Sandy. A brawny, red-haired, red-faced hombre threw his arms around Jesse and hugged her, while a petite brunette and a flock of red-headed kids gathered around her and got their hugs in turn. The man had to be Shad Colton, the brunette his wife, and the youngsters Jesse's younger brothers and sisters. A few yards away on the platform, a thin-faced man with a fringe of gray hair around his ears and a hat thumbed back on a mostly bald head waited for Sandy, along with a plump, pretty woman about the same age who had only a few streaks of silver in her blonde hair. Two blonde boys in their teens, twins from the look of them, were there too. Sandy's brothers, Matt guessed. Even though not that much distance separated the two groups on the platform, it was like a range of mountains between them. Nobody from one bunch even glanced in the direction of the other bunch. It was a damn shame when close families had a falling out like that, Matt thought briefly. Then he forgot about the Coltons, the Paxtons, the Troubles, and turned his attention to reclaiming the saddle mounts and pack horses so he and Sam could go and hunt up the famous, or infamous, Marshal Seymour Standish. Without knocking, Matt opened the door and walked into the marshal's office with Sam right behind him. They both stopped short at the sight of a man standing there pointing a gun at them. It took all of Matt's self-control not to slap leather. Even as fast on the draw as he was, he doubted if he could get his gun out and fire before the man in the marshal's office squeezed the trigger.
Hold it! Don't shoot, mister. We're not looking for trouble.
The man with the gun looked even more surprised than Matt and Sam. He lowered the weapon hastily.
I'm sorry. Don't worry, it's not even loaded.
The man was undoubtedly Marshal Seymour Standish. He had a badge pinned to his black leather vest. A slender man of medium height, he looked smaller still next to the brawny pair of blood brothers. Spectacles perched on his thin nose. Remembering the reference in the newspaper story to the most cowardly man in the West, Matt thought Standish fit the description better than one of a fighting marshal. How could anybody be both? Standish holstered his gun.
What can I do for you, gentlemen?
Matt gestured at the revolver on Standish's hip.
That gun's not loaded? No. I was just practicing my draw when you came in.
Well, hadn't you better load it? What if there was some trouble you had to handle? You are the marshal, aren't you?
That's right, I am. And I suppose I should put the bullets back in the gun.
It shoots better that way.
You haven't told me why you're here. Have you come to report a crime?
You could say that. It just hasn't occurred yet.
You're reporting a crime that hasn't occurred? That's a bit unusual, isn't it?
Call it delivering a warning, then. There's a gang of outlaws on the way here to raid the town. They plan to clean it out of everything valuable, kill anybody who gets in their way, burn down half the buildings, and kidnap the prettiest women they can find before they run off across the border into Mexico.
Standish's eyes widened more and more in amazement as Matt talked. He almost dropped the gun he was holding. Some of the bullets did slip out of his fingers and clatter to the desk, but he managed to raise the revolver, pointed at Matt and Sam again.
Drop your guns!
Hang on! Why are you pointing that thing at us?
You said you were delivering a warning. Doesn't that mean you're members of this outlaw gang you were talking about?
Hell no! We've been chasing those damn owl hoots for more than a week, ever since they raided another settlement up on the panhandle.
We came down here to stop them. We want to help you, Marshal.
Standish looked like he wasn't sure whether he believed that.
Who are you?
I'm Matt Bodine. This is Sam Two Wolves.
Matt could tell their names meant nothing to Standish. That wasn't really a surprise. According to the story they read in the Gazette, Standish came to Texas from somewhere back east. It stood to reason he might not know of Bodine and Two Wolves.
Are you lawmen of some sort? Texas Rangers, perhaps? Or U.S. Marshals?
No, we're just a couple of hombres who hate outlaws.
We were in that other town when Mallory's gang raided it. We saw firsthand what they were capable of, and we want to keep them from doing it again down here.
Mallory?
Deuce Mallory. He's the leader of the gang. Have you heard of him?
Standish shook his head.
Well, if you had, you'd know what a low-down snake he is. Sam and me, we sort of make a habit of stomping snakes whenever we get the chance.
Matt gestured at the revolver still clutched in the marshal's hand.
So why don't you put away that smoke pole and we can sit down and talk about what we need to do to get ready for Mallory?
Get ready? You mean...
I mean you and the folks here in Sweet Apple are going to have to defend the town. Otherwise Mallory and his men will overwhelm it and take over. And trust me, you don't want that.
No. No, I don't. Oh, Lord. What's going to happen next? I'm not cut out for this.
Matt and Sam looked at each other and frowned. They had run across a lot of star packers in their adventurous career, but never one who acted quite like this.
Marshal Standish. Seymour. You mind if I call you Seymour?
Without lowering the hands that covered his face, the marshal shook his head.
Seymour, we may not have much time. You need to, pull yourself together. There's a lot to do.
What? What can we do? If there's an army of outlaws about to descend on Sweet Apple, as you say, then the situation is hopeless. We need to get word to the Rangers, or perhaps the U.S. Army, and hope that help will arrive here in time.
Sure. Send for the Rangers. It can't hurt anything, but you can't count on them getting here before Mallory does.
That's why you've got to be ready. We'll help you.
But there are only three of us. And even men as competent as you two appear to be, Mr. Bodine, can't stand up to that sort of odds.
You're going to have to talk to men that you trust here in town. Tell them to keep the news under their hats for now, because you don't want to panic folks. But if you could round up a couple dozen men who are willing to fight, who'd be ready when the outlaws get here so they don't take us by surprise. It might make all the difference in the world.
I don't see how it's possible. It seems so far-fetched.
Sweet Apple's got a reputation as a tough town. There are bound to be plenty of men around here who are willing to fight.
Well, maybe. You don't have much choice. You either fight or roll over and die.
You don't want to do that.
No. No, I don't. Very well. I can start talking to some of the townspeople. Men I know. I suppose I could deputize them.
Just make sure you talk to fellas you can trust.
You have to understand. I haven't been the marshal here for very long. And to be honest, I'm more a figure of mockery than anything else. I don't really know who I can trust.
Make your best guesses. You don't want word of this leaking out just yet.
For one thing, it's possible Mallory and his gang might not even show up here. They should have been here before now. We thought we'd get here to find the town half destroyed.
Seymour turned even more pale than he already was.
Good Lord. Is there such savagery lurking around every corner out here in the West?
Usually.
Matt went around the desk and clapped a hand on the marshal's shoulder.
But now that you realize that, Seymour, you got a better chance of living to see the sunrise tomorrow.
The Blood Brothers spent a while telling Seymour about the Mallory gang's raid on Buckskin. Hearing all the details made the marshal blanch even more, but Matt and Sam thought it was important Seymour understand exactly what he might be up against. They wanted to know exactly what sort of man they'd be working with, too.
Tell us about what happened in Sweet Apple since you've been here, Seymour. We read a story in the Gazette, but I'm sure there's more to it than that.
Mr. Heathcote thinks I'm good copy, as he calls it. When I first arrived, he built me up to be a cowardly buffoon, which I am, I suppose. But he was also one of the men who came to me and asked me to take the marshal's job.
A man's only as cowardly as he believes himself to be.
And as for being a buffoon, I can already tell that's not the truth. You're an intelligent man, Seymour.
I suppose so. It's true, I always enjoyed school. I've thought before I should have found some sort of academic career. I was never cut out to be a salesman either. But my father was the owner of the company, and he expected me to follow in his footsteps.
Sam and I both know what it's like when a fellow wants to please his pa. But when you come right to it, every man has to figure out his own trail, not just follow somebody else's. No matter how much you admire him.
Yes. Yes, I suppose you're right. But that doesn't help us now, does it?
Nope. Right now you're here, and those outlaws are maybe on their way, and that's what you've got to deal with.
Looking more decisive than he had so far, Seymour stood up and reached for his hat.
Let's go. I have an idea about where to start recruiting defenders for the town.
The three men left the marshal's office and walked along the street toward the Black Bull Saloon. Along the way, Matt felt someone watching him and turned his head to look at the boardwalk. A couple of men loitered there in front of a hardware store. Matt recalled seeing them on the train from Marfa. Both men looked out of place. They wore eastern suits, including derbies. One was short, broad, muscular, and hairy. The other man was tall and thin, with cold reptilian eyes and swarthy skin. Matt felt an instinctive dislike for both of them as the men turned and headed the other way down the street. Seymour pushed the batwings aside and led the way into the Black Bull. Seymour approached one of the men standing at the bar, nursing a mug of beer.
Mr. Halliday, I'd like to talk to you, if you don't mind.
Halliday was the sort Matt and Sam encountered many times before. A two-bit gunman who was no doubt dangerous. Just not as dangerous as he thought.
Well, if it ain't our famous lily-livered marshal, what do you want, Seymour? Want me to shoot that hat full of holes like I did your last one?
Matt stepped to one side and Sam to the other, so they flanked Seymour.
The marshal said he wanted to talk to you, mister.
I'd listen if I was you.
Halliday's eyes flicked back and forth between them.
Who the hell are you two? Seymour the Lily-Livered's new deputies?
Matt and Sam looked at each other and shrugged.
How about it, Marshal? Are we officially deputized?
I suppose that would be the best. Consider yourselves deputy marshals of Sweet Apple.
That still don't tell me who you are.
Name's Matt Bodine.
And I'm Sam Two Wolves.
Recognition flared in Halliday's eyes. He knew those names all right. He knew Bodine and Two Wolves belonged to the same Brotherhood of the Gun he did. Only, They were the big brothers.
What do you want with me? It's two against one.
He wasn't counting, Seymour.
We're not looking for trouble, Halliday.
The Marshal wants to talk to you. That's all.
Slowly, Halliday lifted his left hand and rubbed his jaw.
Well, I reckon that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Halliday. Now, if you'll be so kind as to wait just a moment.
He went over to one of the tables where several men watched the confrontation with looks of surprise and puzzlement on their faces.
Mr. Keller, Mr. Aiken, would you join us?
Seymour turned back toward the bar.
And Mr. Delacroix, you too?
What are you up to, Seymour?
I'm putting together a small discussion group, let's call it. I'd like to talk to the four of you in my office.
Are you arresting us?
Not at all. As I said, I'd just like to talk to you.
Why not? I'm glad to oblige the friend of the charming, Miss O'Reilly.
Matt didn't know what that was about, but he saw the way Seymour's ears suddenly turned red. Whoever Miss O'Reilly was, Matt figured the Marshal was smitten with her. On the way back to the Marshal's office, Matt looked around for the two Eastern dudes he noticed earlier, but he didn't see them.
All right. What is it you and these hired guns of yours want, Seymour?
Seymour looked at Halliday, Keller, and Aiken.
I've had trouble with all three of you men, but I bear you no ill will. I understand that you're all proficient with firearms.
Try us any time you want. Find out for yourself, Seymour.
No. That's not what this is about. You're tough men, I know that.
He looked at the saloon keeper.
You too, Mr. Delacroix. Otherwise you wouldn't have been able to be a success in your profession. I need some tough men to give me a hand.
They all stared at him, clearly not understanding what he was getting at.
You wish to deputize us, mon ami?
Well, unofficially, yes.
I'm no damn lawman.
I did say it would be unofficial.
Why should we want to help you?
Seymour's answer was blunt, and Matt was glad he'd finally stopped beating around the bush.
Because there's an entire gang of outlaws on their way to Sweet Apple, and if we're not ready for their arrival, they might just wipe out the entire town.
The three gunmen and the saloon keeper just stared at Seymour for a long moment, as if he spoke in some foreign language they didn't understand.
How do you know this, Seymour?
They told me.
Seymour nodded toward Matt and Sam.
You know who Bodine and Two Wolves are? Gunfighters. That's who they are. Just a couple of drifting hellions on the lookout for trouble.
That's not quite true.
You calling me a liar, Bodine?
I'm saying that you're misinformed about Sam and me. And you better listen to the Marshal here because he's right about what might happen. Deuce Mallory and his gang nearly destroyed a whole town up in the Panhandle a couple of weeks ago. We were there and saw it with our own eyes.
How do you know this man Mallory and his cronies are headed here?
We went after them. We didn't ever catch up with them, but we did get our hands on one of Mallory's wounded men. He's the one who told us Mallory and the rest of the gang planned to attack Sweet Apple, and then duck across the border into Mexico.
But if this is true, why have the outlaws not attacked the town already? You admitted they were ahead of you, and you did not catch up to them.
Yeah, they should have been here before now. We don't know the answer to that.
Maybe they ain't coming. Maybe they decided to raid someplace else.
That is a possibility. But the possibility still exists they'll come here. We must be prepared for them.
Prepared how, mon ami?
Seymour looked around at them.
We have to get ready to fight.
Why us? It ain't like we're your friends, Seymour.
No, but you live here. When Mallory and his men attack, you'll be in as much danger as anyone else in Sweet Apple. The difference is that men such as yourselves are capable of fighting back.
Damn right we can fight. I ain't afraid of no owl hoots.
How many men does Mallory have?
We're not sure. At least 30, but there could be as many as 40 of the varmints. Who knows what they picked up along the way down here?
The seven of us cannot stop them.
You probably know other men you can trust. Men who can handle themselves in a fight. Help me spread the word. But only to men who are willing to keep the knowledge to themselves. We don't want everyone in the town panicking over something that might not even happen.
The hard cases thought it over.
I never helped the law before.
Something about it rubs me the wrong way.
Halliday silenced them with a slash of his hand.
Sweet Apple's our town, damn it. And Seymour may be lily-livered, but he ain't stupid. I've heard of Deuce Mallory. He kills folks like we'd step on a bug. There ain't no human feeling in him. I don't want to see what him and two dozen snakes just like him would do to this town.
Neither do I.
Two of my bartenders are rugged, courageous men, Seymour, and they can keep their mouths shut. I can recruit them to our cause.
I know some old boys who like a good scrap, too. I reckon they'd agree to give us a hand and keep the trap shut.
Aiken and Keller shrugged and went along with the others, each offering to find some more defenders among the settlement's more disreputable elements.
I'll speak to the members of the town council, too. But for the moment, I can't thank you gentlemen enough. With your help, we will prevail if those outlaws make the mistake of attacking Sweet Apple.
How much time do we have to get ready?
Seymour looked at Matt and Sam.
We honestly don't know. Mallory could strike at any time. Might be a good idea to post a lookout at the highest point in town to give us some warning if a large group of riders approaches.
That would be the roof of the Black Bull. I'll send a man up there as soon as I get back to the saloon.
Seymour nodded in approval of that plan.
The rest of you spread out through town and find more men we can trust.
They started toward the door, but Halliday paused and looked back with a frown.
Are you sure you're the same hombre I hoorahed down at the train station the day you got here, Seymour?
I don't know.